For WKU Public Radio, I'm Kevin Willis. There are two very different narratives that have formed over the sequester. That's the $85 billion in federal spending cuts that are scheduled to start March 1st, unless Congress and the White House agree to a deal involving a different package of cuts and tax increases. President Obama again warned today that a sequester would be catastrophic, impacting air traffic control, military preparedness, and emergency response, amongst other things. On the other side are those that say bring the sequester on, and someone squarely in that camp is Kentucky's junior U.S. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Bowling Green, who came to the studios of WKU Public Radio this morning. We also asked Senator Paul about gun control and about his recent comments concerning America's appetite for a libertarian presidential candidate. But we started by asking Senator Paul for his reaction to predictions of dire consequences if the sequester were to happen.
I would call that histrionics. This is the theater that comes forward anytime we start talking about reducing or slowing down the rate of growth of government. Everybody should realize the sequester does not cut any money, so all of the departments will have what they had last year. What happens is it slows down the rate of growth. And when they say, oh, we're going to turn the lights off in the White House and we're going to close the Washington Monument, this is histrionics to get people hysterical so we don't have a reasonable debate. What's happening now is our country is drowning in a sea of debt. We're borrowing $50,000 a second, cutting spending, even if it's only cutting the rate of gross spending, it's absolutely necessary. So what this shows you is the people who are squawking and the people making all these hysterical claims are people who are going to bankrupt our country if someone doesn't stand up and say, you know what, the emperor has no clothes, we're out of money, we've got to stop.
Is anything going to happen by March 1st?
I think the sequester will go through. That's my prediction now. Even though there are Republicans complaining about it, you're seeing less and less of a complaint on the Republican side and more of a realization that for a change, we have the president where we want him. These spending cuts will occur automatically without a presidential signature and without the Democrats in the Senate voting for them. So we actually have spending cuts, or as I would like to call them, reductions in the rate of growth of spending. We have them automatically, and we would be foolish to let the president get back into where he can expand spending and expand the debt further.
So, Senator, I hear you saying that you are in favor of the sequester moving forward. You think it would actually be good for the country. But do you fear that if it happens, does your party take the blame for that? Does it look in some way irresponsible? Or you mentioned having the president where you want him, that maybe does the GOP risk looking like it didn't bargain in good faith?
Simpson-Bowles Commission said that we needed at least $4 trillion in cuts. The sequester is $1 trillion in cut. There are still many people saying that our debt is going to be downgraded. There are many people like myself worried that we're going to destroy the currency, printing up so much currency to pay for our debt.
Let's talk about the issues of guns, Senator. As you know, following the shootings in Newtown, the issues of gun control, gun rights were front and center once again. For you, are there any changes in law regarding firearms that you could support? For example, do we need to do more to try to keep guns out of the hands of those with documented psychological illnesses? Should there be a limit to the number of bullets that could go into a gun magazine?
I think the deaths at Newtown were a terrible tragedy, and I'm still sort of sickened and saddened every time I see the families and the parents, coming forward who have had kids that were killed in that. I don't know of any proposal that I've heard of yet that would have stopped that shooting. This was a crazy homicidal maniac who got guns that were already registered, and someone made a bad decision leaving them open where he could have access to them. But I don't know of any law that would have prevented this terrible tragedy from happening. Now, what I would say is that transfer of information, the information, many of the states are not providing enough information for the background checks. And so anything we can get for the states to cooperate better with information, so if this person is known and is in a data bank, that we get that into the background checks would be something that I think is to some advantage. Some states are really complying with this and other states haven't.
It may not have prevented somebody from going into a school and shooting, but would a limit on if somebody had to stop and reload, if somebody couldn't just fill a clip with dozens of bullets and shoot them off at a time, could that at least perhaps save some lives? It may not prevent the shooting in the first place, but could you maybe see a lower death count in such cases?
I think the best likelihood of seeing a lower death count would have been if a principal had been armed, if they'd had concealed carry, if a teacher had been armed and had concealed carry and had a weapon locked in the drawer. The killings at Virginia Tech took several hours. Several of them where the insane criminal was beating on the door, and they had plenty of time to have gotten into a locked drawer in their desk and get a weapon. So guns work in self-defense also. The idea of how many bullets are in a clip, people think, oh, this is a panacea. Well, the thing is there are people defending themselves who have a clip also. And so do you want the person defending themselves to have only access to 5 bullets, and the guy breaking down your door has access to 15 bullets?
I've heard you say in recent interviews that you think that the U.S. is ready for more of a libertarian-style candidate, possibly presidential candidate. What is it that you see, Senator, in the country that makes you think that someone who's prescribing libertarian-style solutions would be able to win the Electoral College, say?
I think when the Republicans start out nationally running for president, we're about minus 170 electoral votes. We're minus California. We don't win in Oregon. We don't win in Washington. We don't seem to win in New England. So we have two large sections of the country where we just aren't competitive. So we do need to think about a different strategy, maybe a different face, maybe different ideas. And I think libertarian ideas are more appealing to a broad swath of people. Some of the libertarian ideas that I think attract more people is a strong national defense, but a less aggressive foreign policy, meaning that we do need to defend our country, but we don't need to have large land wars all around the world all of the time, that maybe war is not always the answer. And I think a lot of young people realize that. In fact, a lot of people in the military realize that. If you talk to the young men and women who leave Fort Campbell or who leave Fort Knox and they're coming back, they are brave young men and women. They do their duty. They do as they're told. But when they've done 3 or 4 tours over there, they're not excited about their 5th tour. So really, I think that a different type or a less bellicose foreign policy would be more appealing. I think also on the issues that affect young people, some young people make mistakes, get involved with drugs, do things they shouldn't do, which I'm not in favor of, but also I'm not in favor of locking them up and throwing away the key. There are a lot of federal laws on the books that have mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent crimes such as drug possession. I think young people would like politicians that are a little more open-minded.
Senator, what of a young person who maybe is into some of what you just said about foreign policy, about reforming drug laws, I heard you say, but would say to you, Senator Paul, you're from a party that has a doctrine that's against gay marriage, perhaps gay adoption, against abortion.
I think that the party is big enough for people with various opinions. So that's the first thing. So there may be young people, there may be people in California or in New England who are less socially conservative than Republicans in the South and the Southeast. We need to be a big tent that includes a lot of people, and they don't all have to have this exact same opinion on this. Some of it would be federalism, in the sense that marriage has always been a state and local issue, has never been a federal issue. So not every Republican thinks that marriage needs to be addressed at the federal level. I personally think it's a state and local issue, and ultimately I think it's a religious and personal issue. So there are varying opinions on some of these issues. Am I still conservative and believe in traditional marriage? Yes. But I'm open enough to say that the issue should be more local and that people who disagree can still have a place in the Republican Party. The predominant issues of our day and of all time, really, are usually pocketbook issues, fiscal issues. Can you keep more of your paycheck? Should your government be running deficits? That's primarily where we bring people together. And so I think that's how our party will grow.
Senator Rand Paul is the junior U.S. Senator from Kentucky. Thank you so much for joining us, Senator.
Thanks for having me.
You can find an audio archive of our conversation at our website, wkyufm.org. I'm Kevin Willis.